The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And it's a different sort of podcast, but certainly someone well-connected in the wine world for ages, in the restaurant industry for ages here in Toronto. Board member for Grapes for Humanity, but he goes by many titles. It is Stephen Campbell. Stephen, thank you so much for being part of the podcast today.
It's great to be here.
I want to talk about your background. I love talking about what the restaurant scene was like in the late 70s, early 80s. And you opened up one of the first wine bars in Ontario. I have 1,000 questions about that. But let's get to the main reason. I was chatting with you about it yesterday. There was an event for Grapes for Humanity to start to raise awareness. The auction is now online. Tell people just what Grapes for Humanity, what it's all about.
Grapes for Humanity is a wonderful charity that was started back around 2000. Next year will be our 25th anniversary. It was started by Tony Aspler, one of our great Canadian wine writer, and his partner at the time was Arlene Willis, and they formed Grapes for Humanity. And it's an organization that over the years has just raised millions of dollars for various charities. It's a great organization because we're all volunteers. So when we raise a dollar for charity, you know, in the end, like 90 cents will get to the actual people who need it. So we're very, very efficient. And over the years, we've changed a bit from our original focus. Things like the Halo Trust, which is removes mines from all over war-torn countries. It does a great job. And lately, since my joining the board, we've started to focus our auctions on climate change and trying to help make a difference.
And by the way, throughout this interview, if at any point you hear two dogs, what are your dogs' names again?
Pixel and Sadie.
Yeah. They will not be the first dogs that ever be part of an interview. Stephen Ranger, the wine auctioneer, his dog has been a part of it. Rick Van Sickle, their dog as well.
Maisie.
Yes, yeah. The winemaker for Kloss & Chase, Keith Tyers. Yeah. His dog also has made appearances, so won't be the first, and it won't be the last. Let's get into the wine itself. So, and again, by the way, 90 cents of every dollar goes. That's fantastic, because I think the one thing people worry about with charity is how much of my dollar is actually going to what it's needed versus administration. I think that's an important thing.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about a little bit about the wine, because this is, it's a really cool thing. Grapes for Humanity, the collaborative effort that's involved.
Yeah. This is the fourth auction here we've had in Toronto. And this time we've taken a new tact with our From the Heart series of wines. And this year, what we did, we challenged, 19 different winemakers from 20 different wineries ended up making 7 microlots for us. When I say microlots, they made 10 cases of wine each. They worked in trios, and they worked to take some of their best wine, to blend it with other wineries, to create something truly special. And I think we saw yesterday, they really did.
Who are some of the winemakers there that'll be a part of this?
Well, we've got just a great group. And, you know, one of the things, if you take a look at the red blend, you've got Kelly Mason, Kalus. You've got Anne Sperling from Lely. And you've got Jessica Otting from Taz. So you've got 3 great, great producers getting together to make a red blend. And then, you know, for the Riesling, it's a dream team. The Riesling team is unbelievable. We've got Charles Baker. We've got 30 Bench. And we got Cave Springs, 3 of the absolute creme de la creme producers of Riesling to make a Riesling for us. And Gabe, the winemaker from Cave Springs, who was the lead winemaker, who Ken Cave Springs bottled it, he says it's the best Riesling ever to be made in Niagara. So it's pretty cool.
Okay, here's the funny thing, and it's a constant theme on this podcast, is Riesling. And at what point does Riesling get brought up by someone? And this one took about 4 minutes and 15 seconds. But I think one of the big stereotypes at the event yesterday, what's the wine that everyone's talking about? And there was brilliant Pinots and Gamay and Chardonnay and red blends from Okanagan, like great wines, and wines being made by Kelly Mason and Thomas Batchelder and all these great people. And in the end, what's the wine everyone's talking about first? Was probably the Riesling. It's such a stereotype for people in the wine industry.
And it's really great to see that it's one of the ones that's in the, because we opened her up for auction yesterday, and it's one of the ones receiving some of the first bids is the Riesling lot.
Of course.
Yeah.
Okay, first, where do people go if they want to bid?
At Waddington's is the hosting the website, hosting the auction. So you go to Waddington's auction house, and you'll find on their homepage, you'll find the our auction, and you can go in and bid and browse and see all the wonderful things we have. This auction, I really wanted to, and this is my baby, I organize these auctions, and so I want it to be not just an auction that has, you know, the greatest wine from California or Bordeaux. I really wanted to showcase Canada's best, and we have a number of great, great lots from Canadian wineries. The other thing, though, that we do is also we have a number of dream lots where we've worked with some of the greatest wineries in the planet to provide one-of-a-kind, once-in-a-lifetime opportunities to visit Italy or New Zealand or South Africa and get to have an incredible tasting or stay at some of the world's best wineries.
Grapes for Humanity started in 2000, and I was looking on the website since starting the virtual fundraising events in 2020. You guys have raised over $1.4 million. That's pretty remarkable.
It is pretty remarkable, and you know, it's our little wine auction has become the most successful charity wine auction in Canada, and you know, it's because of we have incredible support from our community, and it's a combination of many, many things, but it's a very nice place to be.
And again, the money's going to the Halo Trust, Tree Canada, and the Nature Conservancy of Canada?
That's right. That's who we're sending the money with for this year, yep.
We were talking about it at the event, to the people for Tree Canada. I was wondering if you could just tell people a little more specifically. They bid on stuff, they win wine, where the money's going to.
Well, with Tree Canada, what you have is that we are supporting their tree planting in Canada. And this year, they are expecting to plant a minimum of 2 million trees in Canada. And considering the situation we have with climate change and the wildfires last year, this is really, really needed. They're the largest nonprofit tree planting company organization in Canada. And then you have the Nature Conservancy of Canada, which is the number one organization conserving land on Canada. Now, and I get a little confused between hectares and acres, but since the beginning of their creation, which is now over, you know, a couple of decades, they've been saving, I'll use the smaller number, 700 acres a week.
Wow.
That's more than just one square mile per week of Canada. So they're doing a great job. And anybody who knows the Halo Trust knows that they're doing incredible jobs removing landmines all over the world. So we want to support the best.
Where did this start for you? Where did your passion, most people, if you ask them, hey, would you like the environment to be better? They're going to say yes. You know, you've made this so much of your life and your time and your energy. Where did that come from?
Somebody from Tree Canada asked me that question yesterday, and I said in 1971, I had to write an essay in my university course about garbage in Canada. And we realized at the time it was unsustainable. And so it just is something that caught me a really, really long time ago. One of the things that I did about it was in 2005, I made my company, Lifford Agencies, carbon neutral. And of course, nobody was doing that at the time. But, you know, it's not about what other people are doing. It's about what you know needs to be done.
What did that mean for the company? Like, what were the steps required? Because, you know,
It was actually quite an extensive audit because we were wine agents and because we were traveling a lot to go to, you know, to wine countries and go to wine fairs and stuff. And we were also in the thing of delivering wine because we were the largest supplier of wine to restaurants for 20 years in Ontario. Through my career. So we had a fleet of trucks that were delivering. We had a number of agents. We had to take a look at every thing that we did that caused carbon to be emitted to the atmosphere. So it was quite a process to get certified to be carbon neutral. And how we did it was we offset the carbon we emitted by planting trees. And over the time that we did this, I funded planting 93,000 trees with Treat Canada to offset our footprint.
Yeah, that would be a lot of work. As you said, there's a lot of travel. Wine is travel. It's coming from all over the world, and then you've got to get into the hands of your customers. So yeah, there's going to be a lot of planes, trains, and automobiles.
Yes, yeah, there is.
Let's go back a little bit. I'm curious here because, you know, when I was doing the research, I was like, I wanted to make sure to interview you and to help raise awareness for Grapes for Humanity. And people, right now, as you're listening to this, go to the website and take a look at the experiences, the wines, and check out the cool stuff being made in Ontario, the collaboration of a lot of great wine, a lot of really talented winemakers. I'm curious, you owned Les Maisons from 1978 to 85. What was the restaurant scene like back in the late 70s?
Well, you can imagine it was quite a bit different, but, you know, I was always a little bit ahead of the curve. And so in 1978, believe it or not, I was doing farm-to-table cuisine in St. Clair. I was buying things like I would buy, you know, a quarter of a cow and I would serve everything, you know, I was growing fresh herbs in my bathtub in the back, and I was recycling my glass and my cans in 1978 when absolutely no one else was doing. We always had vegetarian food on our menu. People loved it. They just like, because nowhere else, they couldn't get it anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got crazy about wine, and I just fell in love with wine, and I bought one of the only wine bars in Canada at the time was a restaurant called Valet, and I changed the name to Delisle Restaurant and Wine Bar. Now, and I did that in 1985. Now, you have to remember, in 1983, which is 2 years before I bought my wine bar, Baby Duck was one in four bottles of wine sold in Ontario.
Wow.
So 2 years later, I'm opening up a wine bar in Toronto.
Okay, hold on. Your friends and family, what did they say to you about opening a wine bar in 1985?
Oh, it was crazy, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had that wine bar for 10 years, and mm-hmm. in 1988, I won my first Wine Spectator Award of Excellence for having an outstanding wine list, one of the most outstanding wine lists in the world. At that time, in 1988, only four restaurants in all of Canada received that award.
Really?
So
what was on your list? And it's probably hard to remember, but I'm curious maybe because I studied history in university, I'd love to know what the wine list was and was like in the late 80s, and one that would get you that award on Wine Spectator.
Well, one of the things that I did, well, first of all, I want to say one thing right off the bat, is that on my list of wine, and we had an extensive list of wine by the glass, an extensive list of wine by the bottles, the very first wines by the glass, and the very first wines by the bottle were always Canadian.
That must have been so rare in the mid-80s, because the wine industry then versus, I mean, even now, you know, we still are fighting for proper recognition, and the wine quality now is so remarkably consistent. That must have been so rare.
Well, it wasn't many people doing it. But the other thing I did, and I was very fortunate that I had the, I was, my place was, my restaurant was very much appreciated, even by people like at the LCBO, and I give them credit, because I was complaining that as a wine bar in Ontario, there's no aged wine to be had. And at the time, you know, you could buy, I could go to Chicago and buy wine at auction and at very fair prices. And the LCBO let me buy wine at Christie's auctions in Chicago and help me import wine into my restaurant.
The LCBO helped you import
Absolutely.
Wine?
Absolutely. They did. They would pick it up for me in Chicago and bring it to Toronto and then test it to make sure it was, of course, you know, had nothing wrong with it. So I had the only restaurant in Canada that you could come and buy a 61 Bordeaux, mm-hmm. a 70 Bordeaux. I had 1920 Bordeaux on my list. I would serve 1970 Bordeaux by the glass. I would serve anything by the glass, whether it was Tignanello, Sesicaia, Gaia, so many different things I would serve by the glass. And because it was so rare, people would come and it was successful. It was sold.
Oh yeah, I'm hearing that now. That would have been so exciting. I'm almost afraid to ask what the prices were back then and just how much more inexpensive it was back in the late 80s, early 90s.
Okay, so here's something. So I was buying wine at auction in Chicago, 1970 classified growth Bordeaux's, you know, second, third, fourth, fifth growth. I could buy them for about $10 a bottle. Ugh. The 66s were $15 a bottle. I remember buying a 61 Lescombe for $35 a bottle. You know, the one deal that stands out for me that is completely shocking in today's was that I bought 16 bottles of Latache. Now, it was a bunch of different vintages, but there was two magnums of 66 and two bottles of 66 and everything. The oldest one was 62 and the youngest one was 72. Mm-hmm. 16 bottles of Latache, $1,800 American.
Yeah, that's a lot for that. That's both a lot and that's nothing.
Yeah. And today,
wow,
one of those bottles would be worth more than that.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, so it's Jesus. A different time.
Yeah, it really is. You must have really loved wine. You talked about earlier about how one in four bottles was Baby Duck, and you're opening a wine store, or a wine bar. Excuse me.
I fell in love with wine, and wine is something that if you fall in love with it, this you can't know enough.
Yes.
So you just you want to travel, you want to see the vineyards, you want to taste everything possible. And I did. I just had the incredible opportunities. Again, because wine was so much cheaper, I had incredible opportunities to taste things.
It's true. It is one of the tough things. It's like a lot of things in life. If you're a sports fan, you're going to be going to fewer and fewer Leaf games because the tickets are too expensive. If you're a fan of Pinot Noir, you're not going to get to try a lot of the great examples in Burgundy because they're too expensive as well. It's one of the shames. It's just how much everything's gone up in price.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because one of the things I did train as I got my sommelier degree from George Brown in 1990. I was one of the first sommeliers in Ontario. You know, at that time, you could basically sample anything. But now that some of these wines are $1,000 a bottle, it's pretty difficult if you want to try Mouton on any kind of basis.
Yeah.
Or, you know, any kind of Burgundies. They've just gotten to be so expensive. So it's really, really difficult.
Getting all those Latashes like you did back then. Damn, that is remarkable. How different is Canadian wine now versus when you open up the wine bar?
You know, what I've noticed, and I see this the same kind of thing that happened, you know, in another wine growing areas like, say, Napa Valley, is that you have the pioneers, you know, and here we have Enniskillen, which was a great, the first one in 50-some years or something. And then others started to come along, right? And you had people like Henry Pelham, and you had people like Cave Springs, sort of the next generation. And of course, the next generation come along, well, they want to improve upon the last generation. And now what we're seeing here in Ontario is the constant entrance of new people coming into the business, all of them wanting to do better than the people before them. So we're building our wine industry on the shoulders of giants. If we didn't have Enniskillen, if we didn't have the Cave Springs, if we didn't have the Henry Pelhams, the ones that were the pioneers, we wouldn't have the Dobbins of today.
Yes.
Right? We wouldn't have the Thomas Batchelders of today. It's wonderful to see the evolution of the Canadian wine industry and the devotion to make the very, very best wines we can. And yesterday, I don't know if you... Were you there when David Laurison was talking?
Yep.
David started the Canadian Wine Awards, like, I don't know, decades ago. And he just talked about the evolution here in Ontario and how in the last few years it's just been an acceleration of quality that he's been witnessing and how wonderful it is to see.
There are so many also younger winemakers, and you can see it, you know, in Westcott, Kelly Mason, the people, and also all these winemakers, the people that work under them, and then they grow, and then you can see sort of this next wave of winemakers throughout Niagara.
Absolutely, and it's really a blessing to see that.
You know what, let's talk about an old school, the importance of Tony Aspler. A two-parter. Points of Tony Aspler for everything with Grapes for Humanity and for the Ontario wine scene. But we'll start with the Grapes for Humanity.
No one has written more books about the Canadian wine industry than Tony. And no one, you know, has had a longer career in writing about wine in Canada than I can think of than Tony. And so he's been an incredible asset to the Canadian wine industry. And then he goes out and he forms this organization, Grapes for Humanity, that on top of all his benefits he's given to the industry from his writing, he's now helped, you know, raise millions of dollars for charity and do good works all over the planet. So, you know, he's just one of our absolute, you know, what can you say, a saint of a human being. And a guy who's always had a great sense of humor. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you that one of the things that happened to me with Tony was that when I'm back in my restaurant days and Tony was in being a customer and buying a nice bottle of wine, I was decanting it for him. And wouldn't you know it, at that very moment, the bottom of the decanter falls out and the wine is all over the table. And Tony looks at me and laughs. He says, I bet you didn't want that to happen in front of me, did you, Stephen? And they just laughed about it. And that was all there was to it. Just a great guy.
I know you can't talk about the story of Ontario Wine without Tony Assler. We'll do it a couple times. What's the website? Where do people go for the wine auction?
Wine auction is Waddington. So you go to Waddington's website, you'll see the Grapes for Humanity auction. It's on the front page. And mm-hmm. It says, bid or browse. Forget browsing. Start bidding.
Yes, absolutely. My strategy, like when it comes to wine auctions, I basically avoid the Bordeaux, Burgundies, things like that, because I know that's going to be the series collectors, people with more money, or restaurants. Me, it's Canada, Germany, and New Zealand Pinot. That's my three-pronged attempt. That's what I do.
Well, there's some really great New Zealand Pinot Noir there. There's a number of Felton Road Pinot Noirs, which is one of the legendary Pinot Noir producers from New Zealand. One of the things on the website of Waddington's, there's an interview with Thomas Batchelder. And Thomas Batchelder talks about his auction strategy. And just like you, he's not after the creme de la creme that's going to go for thousands of dollars a bottle. You'll see on our website, those bottles are already attracting a lot of attention. The lesser known wines and some of the lesser known vintages, that's where you're going to get value.
Yeah.
And so you just, you know, it's don't overlook some of those lots that, you know, that there's a lot of really great value.
I'm conflicted right now, Stephen, because everything you said made sense. And I want to edit this part out because I have the good angel, bad angel. And the good angel is we need to promote this. We need to raise money. This is for charity. My girlfriend is a nonprofit charity herself, a school in Mombasa, Kenya. And then there's the other side of me saying, everyone leave Mosul and Otago and Ontario alone. Just leave those alone. Let me go and play there and everyone beat it. But yes, that is the exact right strategy.
Well, I can't take my bids away already. I don't know what I'm going to do.
Actually, that sort of goes into one thing I wanted to discuss, and it goes with the price of Burgundy and also lesser known areas. I've been telling people over and over for years, and I opened a 20 Wismy Parkey Thomas Batchelder Pinot last night and decanted it for a couple hours, and it's fantastic. It's around $50. Might be a little more, but that wine, for people that aren't going to be able to try Premier Cru Volnay, I would say go to places like Batchelder or Mason or Cloudsley Cellars. Like I think there is a lot of places you can go. You might not get 100% of what you're looking for, but you might get 91% at 35% the price.
Yes, and you know, one of the unfortunate things that's happened with climate change is that it's had a really been very impactful in Burgundy. And
yes.
Of course, people in Burgundy, they're not going to tell you that. But unfortunately, climate scientists tell us it's already too warm in Burgundy to successfully grow Pinot Noir. Now, that is a crushing shame, but it is also the truth. So now, when you have Burgundy, you will notice that has become more California-like. And California Pinot is very ripe, it's very fruity, but it's lacking the nuances of cold climate Pinot Noir. And if you've had great Burgundy from the past, you know that it's impacted by the cooler climate, and you're not just getting fruit.
Yeah.
You're getting secondary and tertiary flavors that have made Burgundy famous throughout the world. And they're having a harder and harder time to achieve those kinds of nuances in their wine, unfortunately. But where it still is here in our little cool climate here in Ontario, where you're getting really compelling Pinot Noirs being made by a number of amazing wineries here. If you're a Pinot Noir lover and you think that Burgundy is not as is better than Ontario, I just grab a few bottles of the 2020 Pinot Noirs, some of the great producers from Ontario. Put them up against anything. I don't care.
Yeah.
But do a taste of blind. You're going to be shocked how good these Pinot Noirs are.
Are we starting to see 15%? In Burgundy on the Pinots, are they getting up there?
Well, they're certainly getting higher than they ever been. You have to remember that conventionally a Burgundy, you know, in the past would be, you know, 12.5% alcohol, you know, and they'd have to chaptalize to get there because it's so cold, right? Not anymore.
No, and that is a shame. And it's always, you know, whenever you get in debates with people that are talking about climate change, what's real, what's not, blame the media. And whenever I'm in those conversations, I avoid most of it. I just tell people that are skeptical. I'm like, here's what I'll tell you. I talk to the winemakers. They're picking 3 weeks, 4 weeks earlier than what they did 15 years ago. That right there is, if you don't want to trust any media source, well, I can show you the pick dates. There's no politics. There's no nothing. That's just what the climate has done to certain areas of the world.
It is an unfortunate situation. And that's why it's important that we raise money to do something about it, right? Because, you know, if we look at our world today, we have governments that are conflicted over solving the immediate needs of our population, which is housing, which is the cost of food, and it's unemployment. And these things are really important, and there's no question. But it takes away from them doing things about the greater problem, which is the long-term problem, which is global warming, which is causing, incredible devastation in the world. And if you look here at Canada, last year what happened is so shocking. And let's just talk about wine in Canada and how shocking it is. First of all, we have to go back until the 22th winter in here in Ontario, where a polar vortex made massive damage in Niagara and killed some vineyards completely, and they had to be replanted. And that was bad enough, but then the 23 winter came along, and we had massive damage in Nova Scotia and in British Columbia. I spoke to a winemaker in British Columbia about the harvest in 2023, last fall. And he said, well, I'm down about 500 tons out of 900 tons. So he lost more than half of his crop to the previous 2023 frost, polar vortex. And then, unfortunately, here we go into January 2024, and we've had a two-day polar vortex that hit the Okanagan wine region and has caused almost 100% crop loss for 2024. This is an incredible tragedy. Right now in BC, we don't know how bad the vineyards have been damaged, how many will have to be replanted. What we do know is that nobody's going to have a crop in 2024, and we know that all of a sudden there's an explosion of wineries for sale in British Columbia, because small wineries cannot afford to replant, not afford to lose 50% of the crop and then 100% of the crop and have to replant. It's a real tragedy.
And then replanting, now you have to wait years before now you can actually make wine in that area as well. And you're right, like there are the larger places. Mission Hill will survive, Checkmate will survive, and thank God they make incredible wines. But I feel bad, as you said, the small ones, the tiny ones, the little ones. Kelly Mason, her doppelganger in Okanagan, I don't know how someone like that could survive, just because the young and just early on, and they don't have years and years and years of old back vintage wines, and they have the capital to be able to survive what will be, could be 2 or 3 years of making almost nothing.
Well, and if you could imagine, you're a winemaker, a wine owner in British Columbia, and you've had these 2 years of massive damage, what's your optimism for the future?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so are we witnessing what scientists are telling us? I mean, climate scientists are telling us that 40% of the vineyard land in California by 2050 will not be able to produce wine. Are we witnessing the first death of a wine region in the world? Are we?
Yeah.
I don't know. You don't know. Nobody knows. But it's that bad.
To lighten the mood a little bit, it needs to be said, your dog is such a suck. Your dog has, like, it's my fault. I pet the dog, but if I put my hand down, your dog is whacking my hand, demanding I continue to pet your dog for this entire interview.
Well, golden retrievers are like that.
Yes,
they are. Everyone's best friend.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this dog here is just the entire time. What was the training like? Going back, and I'm sorry, like, usually, you know, these interviews, there can be more structured. I like to bounce around a little bit. But you studied George Brown. You were one of the first sommeliers in Ontario in 1990. What was the training like back then?
I had to laugh because Jacques Marie was the leader of the sommelier. He was the teacher at George Brown who taught us sommelier. So a French guy, so he knew a lot about wine, and he liked to teach us about wine by telling stories. And so we had a lot of stories. We had to do a lot of our own sort of studying around the edge because he was a lovely man and loved wine. We just, you know, it was a thing that in that class in 1990, I think there was 25 of us in the class, and I think three or four of us passed.
Wow.
So just a few of us made it through.
Yeah.
It wasn't easy because, of course, nobody... There was really no wine culture in 1990, so people didn't know much about wine. So to pass a course as rigorous as the sommelier course, I was fortunate enough to get through.
Does it amaze you just the leaps and bounds of wine culture? You open up a restaurant, then a wine bar, where at the LCBO you had to sign a sheet of paper and get the wine, and everyone's drinking Baby Duck. We've seen it grow. We've seen it change. Just the difference between the wine culture now. And then, you know, movies, more movies, documentaries on it. It seems like a completely different world today than what it was when you passed.
Yes, and it's been wonderful to watch the evolution and how it's become, wine has become more mainstream part of Canadian culture. And people embrace it. And now when you go to restaurants, you'll see everybody's got multiple wines by the glass. They have extensive wine lists. It's really become something, a part of our community. So it really is quite a change from what it was.
Could you have believed that at the time? In 1985, if we showed you a peek into the future of 2024?
Well, you know, at the time, you know, can you imagine 1985? So I had a few hundred wines on my wine list, and I was one of the number one wine lists in the country. And now you have places here that have thousands of wines on their wine lists. Any kind of modest restaurant might have a couple hundred wines on their wine list. So it's really has changed. And when people realize, I think that restaurants will realize that a successful wine program is an essential part of any restaurant. It attracts people, it gets people to come back. If it's well put together, you know, people are going to come back to your restaurant, not just for the food, not just for the ambiance, just for the, you know, the friendly service. The wine is another thing that brings people back. And the restaurant industry, you know, I love restaurants. And, I started cooking when I was like 4 or 5 years old, and I had to have a restaurant. So when I was 25, I opened a restaurant. And restaurants are absolutely about passion and people being passionate about what they're doing. But it's also a business where you need to have passionate about every little thing in your restaurant. And restaurants are amalgamation of the food, the ambience, the wine lists, the service, everything. It's a complete package. And to get that, to perfect that when you have a complete package, that separates, you know, the people who want to have a restaurant and the people who actually do. And unfortunately, what we see in the restaurant industry, the average restaurant lasts about 6 months or something. And when I look back, and I had my first restaurant for 7 years, I had my second restaurant for 10 years, and I just was always, always, always paying attention what the trends were, what people were doing, and I was never, ever satisfied with what I was doing, and I was constantly changing things to make them better. And I can remember it close to the end where people say, "Steven, I've been your customer for so long, I can't believe how consistent you are." And I just say, "Oh, that's really nice. Thank you so much." Mm-hmm. But what they didn't realize that it wasn't consistent at all. If there was anything consistent about it, we were consistently getting better. And that's what you have to do in business. That's what you have to do in restaurants to survive. You can never stand on your laurels. You have to continue to evolve and give people a reason to come back. And it's the same in the wine business, right?
I was going to say, it's funny. You talked earlier that once you fall in love with wine, you'll never learn it all. And you're constantly wanting to learn. That sounds similar to running a restaurant, but constantly wanting to learn and evolve. And actually, before we end this, tell people a little bit about Stephen, not the restaurateur or the sommelier or Grapes for Humanity, the winemaker. We're here at your house and you've got a bunch of your wines here.
Well, one of the things I've done over the years before, I was always, like I said, I was interested in the environment. I went carbon neutral in 2005. Right around 2005, I developed a range of wines, which I called Planetary. I was really, in this situation, too far ahead of myself because I put them in plastic bottles at a time when people were not interested in plastic bottles. And I had three general listed wines, Merlot, a Chardonnay, and a Cabernet Sauvignon at the LCBO. And with every bottle we sold, we planted a tree, which was a great idea.
Yeah.
But the problem with trying to plant a tree with every bottle in Ontario is that you have to put the cost of planting that tree into the price of the wine, which results in the wine being too expensive for the quality that you receive. So unfortunately, the wines were not successful, and plastic was definitely not it. So it took me quite a while to figure out, okay, well, what should I do if I can't do that? So because I still want to do carbon neutral wines. One of the things that perplexes me as a consumer is that all the climate scientists say we should try to reduce our carbon footprint. And yet, as a consumer, what can you buy that's carbon neutral? How many things do you know? So I decided that my next project was to create an international family of carbon neutral wines. And they're called Stephen Campbell Kind Wines. And I was very, very lucky because of my import business. I knew some of the greatest winemakers on the planet. And I asked them to help me. And so I made wine in New Zealand with Steve Smith, Master of Wine, one of the legends in New Zealand. I made wine in Spain with Telmo Rodriguez, one of the great guys in Spain. Bruce Jack made my wine for me in South Africa. I worked with amazing family, the Mitchell family in Clare Valley, to make me a Shiraz in Australia. I just had I made two Canadian wines, one with Anne Sperling, mm-hmm. Sperling Vineyards in the West, one with Paul Pender at Taz, and we made a Riesling. So, and that was those were wines that were popular, but they came at the end of my career at Lifford, and unfortunately, I decided to retire and sell Lifford. These wines have gone into the ether. They're no longer being produced. But I had sold my business 6 weeks before COVID started.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, and then COVID starts and all the restaurants are closed down, and my whole life's been restaurants and wine. So that's when I went to Grapes for Humanity. I said, guys, we got to do something. And so let's do a charity wine auction. And they were immediately, yeah, let's do it. It was a little problematic because charity wine auctions were allowed, but it was against the law to have a virtual one. You can only have a live one. It means you can only sell wine to the people in the room. Well, that's
not going to happen, especially not during COVID.
We really had a trouble getting our first license. And unfortunately, common sense prevailed, but the authorities weren't going to give it. We reached out to some politicians who helped us persuade the powers to be to give us our first license. And that was really, and it was great. And we've changed it for everybody, because now everybody does virtual wine auctions. And a lot of new wine auctions have come out of this because of this virtual, because we can raise so much more money. But our very first wine auction, we raised over $500,000. And it was pretty amazing. And so then the board of directors of Grapes for Humanity asked me if I would join. And I said, okay, I'll join as long as I can continue to do my auctions, but we have to change. We have to, because the first auction was all about hospitality and restaurants. And I said, my charity thing is environment. I want to support the environment. And Grapes for Humanity actually blessed them. They changed their charter to allow us to support charity auction, or to do charity auctions and support climate change initiatives. And so since then, we've been supporting the three organizations, Tree Canada, Nature Conservancy, Halo Trust, and it's worked out to be really, a fantastic thing.
This has been fantastic. Thank you so much, Stephen, for doing this. And what a remarkable life in wine you've had, cooking at the age of four, starting a restaurant, recycling, vegetarian, Canadian wine, opening a wine bar in 85, becoming a Somme, Lifford, Great for Humanity, carbon neutral, and everything in between, and the stuff I've missed. It's remarkable. I mean, it's a really cool story, and I appreciate you taking time. And before we end this one last time, I want to go and bid on some Central Otago Pinots, and also I want to bid on some local Ontario collaborated, I don't even think that's a word, wines made through collaboration of some of the great winemakers of this area. Where do I go?
Go to Waddington's. Go right to their website. You'll see the Grapes for Humanity auction, and join us. These From the Heart series.
Yeah.
It was so great yesterday to see all the winemakers in one room trying for the first time these wines and the smiles on their faces.
It's so true. It's so, you know what? I should have mentioned that because I was at the event there yesterday. First, it's cool being in this room just surrounded by Hall of Famers, elite talent. I come from a sports background. I'm like, oh my God, there's all-stars all over the place. And yes, watching them try their wines and being excited about it and happy and then debating, you know, the tannins of that Pinot versus another wine and everyone gushing over the Riesling, of course. It was really cool, and they're great wines. Like I'm going to be bidding on some of those because these are winemakers I trust who are making wine in a great part of the world to make Pinot and Chard and Gamay and Riesling. Thank you so much for doing this.
You're very welcome.
Thanks everyone for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Spotify, iTunes, Apple, wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.